Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to witness some scenes from the next attraction to play this theater. This picture, truly one of the most unusual ever filmed, contains scenes which under no circumstances should be viewed by anyone with a heart condition or anyone who is easily upset. We urgently recommend that if you are such a person or the parent of a young or impressionable child now in attendance, that you and the child leave the auditorium for the next 90 seconds.
Hello, my name is Christopher.
My name is Laura.
My name is Nicholas.
Our daddy is the gourmet.
And you're listening to the Room Lore Podcast.
All right, this is Feedback, and it's my great pleasure to welcome to the Roomorg studio of Decapitation and Evisceration for the very first time in person, the Roomorg columnist and grumpy quadragenarian himself, the gourmet. How are you, sir?
Well, long time no vidy, my brother.
Of course, this is your first time in person. We did hear from you during one of Lance's terrible phone pranks. I didn't have anything to do with that, I swear. And, you going to talk to him?
Yeah. He's not going to
answer. Hello?
Hey, is Gourmet there?
Speaking.
Hey, Gourmet, it's Beelzebub calling you from New Jersey.
Bill!
How you doing?
Why do you sound like Lance? From Org.
So we're trying to figure out here, Gourmet, who's in tight more with Beelzebub, you or Lance?
And it's me.
I closed the strip joint down with Bill. Did you?
I actually did. In Toronto here, we went to Cheaters. I waited in the car, because I don't go into those places.
And of course, we've heard some of your comments on the show via secondary sources. And we'll get into that a bit later. If you're feeling appropriately repentant enough to discuss those issues. But first of all, you've got to explain the trio of beings that you came with to the studio. Who are these people?
My children.
Your children.
My daughter,
somebody
Laura?
Somebody actually allowed you to reproduce three times.
Well, once was an accident.
So who are these kids? What are their names?
Well, Laura is my 10-year-old daughter. Mm-hmm. The next is Christopher, my older boy, and my youngest, Nicholas, who is 6.
All right, the concept of the gourmet as father to 3 small children is a bit weird. It's a bit strange because generally when I do see you, when it's outside of this environment, you're standing in a corner drooling, like with a bottle of beer in your hand, and it's just like, what is the gourmet like as a dad? Like, what's a typical home environment like? Like, a typical day in the life of gourmet as a dad? Presumably, you're looking after the kids this week.
Yeah.
Well, right, on your own.
Yeah, my wife's at work. I make them lunch. I cook dinner for the family. I do dishes.
What do you make for dinner?
All kinds of things. Spaghetti, chili, hoisin, chicken.
So you're a pretty normal dad.
Yeah, believe me, there's nothing strange that goes on. All my madness is kept down in the basement. My den. Well, it's a townhouse. It's a half basement walk out to the backyard. Half of it's my computer desk and part of my DVD collection and then part of my death metal CD collection. The other half's the laundry room, so.
So you keep all your sickness hidden away in the basement?
Yeah, more or less.
Right.
Sometimes I truly believe that what I sell is the American dream.
That a man could be driven to do something like that to his own family, to his children.
It's okay, sweetheart. I won't hurt you.
Maybe they disappointed him.
He's a wonderful man, and he wants to care for us. There's just something about him.
Father knows best.
Just because you're all crazy and demented.
Stephanie, don't you talk to your father that way.
We have to talk, honey.
About what?
About what is happening to our family.
I'm taking care of it. You're a very bad girl. We are going to keep this family together. You had better believe it!
So what do you like to do with your kids?
Oh, I'll take them to the park. Let them play in the playground, or we go to the water park. If they're getting a little older, they play outside by themselves now. You know, they don't need me to do everything. But yeah, sometimes we'll sit down and, you know, watch something together. I've been introducing them to...
guinea pig films?
No.
August Underground?
No, we're keeping it very age.
What the hell do you watch with them then?
Just last week we started watching the original Kolchak the Night Stalker TV series.
Oh, okay.
I watched that on TV when I was 8 years old too.
Right.
My 8-year old loves it.
So they respond well to the stuff that you show them that's old?
Yeah, oh yeah, they've... no problem. I watch them, like the Ant movie from the 50s.
Right.
Christopher loved it. He watched it twice.
So unlike their father, these kids look like they may have some good taste in films.
Where do you think that it's coming from? I mean, what you see me write about in the magazine is not the sum total of the kinds of movies I like to watch.
Right.
I have a broader cinematic taste than
I
that.
I understand that.
But I do think it's important to show my kids different kinds of movies, like from different eras, black and white. You haven't gotten to subtitles yet, but another one that's really popular is Ultraman.
Okay.
The original Ultraman series, right. Which is something I grew up with. You know, just different cultures.
That played on TV in America, didn't it?
It did.
Ultraman, yeah.
You've been enlisted into a top secret agency called Guts. You have access to the world's most advanced weapons and technology. Ultraman Tiga can't do it alone. He needs your help.
He's the one 10 stories high.
Save the world!
Ultraman! He's the hope for all mankind.
Save the world!
Ultraman!
So do you like being a dad?
I love being a dad.
Yeah?
Yeah.
They don't get on your nerves?
All the time. But you just deal with it. Last year was the first year I was able to take all three of them to the Fan Expo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the big convention, because they've been wanting to go. And this was the first year I didn't have strollers and diapers and all that stuff to worry about. It's the first year that I could take them all down there and everybody could walk around. And on the way home in the car, Christopher's comment was, this was the best day of my life, because they just were totally in awe of all the costumes and the exhibits and everything else. It was great. And, you know, I'm happy that I can now share, you know, this aspect of my life with them.
Well, that's nice. When are you going to introduce them to the hard stuff?
Well,
these are all just gateway drugs you get hooked on.
But see, the thing is, by not putting a forbidden fruit aspect to anything, just saying, okay, well, you can watch that when you're a little older. You're not ready for this now.
Mm-hmm.
They're satisfied with that because they do get to watch something. It's not as if, you know, I'm chasing them away with a stick. Get away from those DVDs, are evil. You know, you shouldn't see them. Through there, you know they exist. They don't know what's on them, but they do get to see some of them. Things that are age-appropriate, Ray Harryhausen movies, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, those kind of things. You know, it was great. I think it's a great way to introduce kids to, you know, the fantasy movies and horror movies, too.
We'll be right back.
Well, let's begin by talking about the history of the Gourmet. Now, I've dug something up from my own private archives here. This is from the Feedback Rumorg collection. I do have a pristine array of old Rumorg magazines that I very rarely ever defile. So this is a big deal that I brought them in here today. This is issue 7. And on page 18, there's an article by Joe O'Brien called Demons on the Web, The Lurker's Guide to Alt Horror. Let me just read the heading.
Alt.horror.
Alt.horror, yeah.
The Usenet news group.
Exactly. Let me just read the heading, and then we'll get into what Alt.horror was all about. It's a dangerous-sounding place, a dark, electronic netherworld, invisible and unknown to many, filled with flames and lurkers and trolls. Its macabre denizens have names like Schizo, Evil Ed, The Gourmet, Dr. Volpagus, Tarantula. They are a tight community of horror fans. They know each other's likes and dislikes, each other's attitudes and opinions, each other's dreams and nightmares. And most of them have never met face to face. So there you go. I believe that's the very first mention of the Gourmet in Rumorg magazine.
Yeah, that would be correct.
So what was Alt.horror all about, and what was your involvement?
Alt.horror is still around. Usenet is still around. It's pretty dead these days. Usenet was the original bulletin board system.
Mm-hmm. It was not the original one.
Well, not the original,
but the popular one.
Yeah. It was a network through all the universities and everything else. Mm-hmm. It sort of ran beside the World Wide Web, the Internet as we know it now. And it was, I can't even remember how I stumbled across it, but I did, because at that time I was running a website, The Galloping Gourmet.
An actual website.
An actual website, yes.
The Galloping Gourmet. That's where it all started.
Yeah, it was a website I started in 1996. And it was when the internet was first starting to come into the general public conscience. I was going to Seneca College at the time for electronics engineering. And, you know, I was absolutely fascinated by the internet. And I decided that I needed to learn how to make a website. Mm-hmm. So I thought, what am I going to do? Well, I'm going to do one on a band. Well, there was already like 100 pages for every band you could conceivably think of. So looked around. There wasn't much horror. I thought, well, I'm a big horror fan. I'm going to do one on horror. What am I going to do? So I thought about it. And the first thing that came to mind was I need a name for it. So there used to be a cooking show that was shown here in Toronto at lunchtime that I'd see when I came home from school called The Galloping Gourmet.
What was his name?
Graham Kerr.
Graham Kerr. And he was actually from England.
Yes.
And before he migrated to Canada, I used to watch him in England on British television when I was a kid. And he was also called The Galloping Gourmet.
Yeah. So, of course, I had the ingenious idea of permutating gourmet into the spelling that I use. So
brilliant.
So that was the website. I had not assumed the mantle as a character at this point. It was just a website. I had, you know, capsule reviews. It was kind of goofy, and I had longer reviews, and I had lots of graphics I was scanning images in from old gore zones.
So what sort of films would you write about?
Zombie, Fulci Zombie, Dawn of the Dead, Evil Dead. You know, whatever I had in my collection or had seen Halloween.
Right.
I expanded it. I didn't realize at the time, but that's how I learned how to write like 150-word reviews, just by doing that, because, you know, I had sort of different sections, little short reviews and then longer pieces. And when I approached Rodrigo Godino about appearing in Rumorg, you know, all I wanted to do was submit a review and have it printed.
Right.
So I could show my kids, hey, one day, look, you know, Daddy was printed in a horror magazine. So that would have been 1999, somewhere, I guess, November 99, because my friend Joe O'Brien and his writing partner, Brad Abraham, also a friend of mine, were already contributing to the magazine. So I went through them. They recommended me to Rodrigo. So I met him. I said, you know, here's my website. Check it out. You know, have a look. So gave him my phone number. I got a phone call from him in January asking me to come down and visit him and, you know, have a talk about doing something for the magazine. So I went down to St. Clair and Oakwood trying to find the office. It was the original office. I couldn't find the place. So I got off the bus and I'm looking around. I can't find the place, but there's this old Italian junk shop. So I'm like, okay, well, look, there's some VHS tapes in the back. So he started rooting around. I pulled out the, you know, the plastic clamshell for the Astral Video release of The Prowler. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, oh, cool. Stuck that in my bag. Finally found the office. I was late. Sat down with Rodrigo. We started to talk. And before I could say, you know, hey, I just want to submit a review and have it printed in your magazine, he offered me the column. So I looked at your website. I really liked what you did. You know, I want you to do something like that for the magazine every month. Well, at the time, it was every 2 months. So originally, I was doing, like, VHS bargain bin, dusty treasures, you know, found in your local mom-and-pop store.
Basically what Bowen does now.
More or less. So, yeah, I started out that way.
He stole your column.
He stole my idea. So, you know, it's over time, it's sort of changed a little.
When did you first become aware of Rue Morgue magazine? I'm assuming it was prior to the article on alt.horror.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, that would have been the 1997 Fantasia Festival they had here in Toronto. John Van Reese, who used to, you know, do stuff for Rod for the magazine, was selling copies of it in the
98.
Lobby.
98.
98. Well, that would have been when I found Rue Morgue. I bought copies of 2, 3, and 4.
That's exactly when I found Rue Morgue, too.
That's when Joe and Brad found Rue Morgue. That's where most of us, I think, who have been with the magazine for a long time found it.
It was Rod and some other bloke was sitting in the lobby with copies of the magazine, and some of them were free. I think issue 2 was free, and then you could buy, like, the next 3 for, like, $5 or something.
Yeah. So that's how I got involved. And the one thing I didn't touch on was when Rod approached me about the column, you know, I was just going to write it under my real name, but he's like, no, no, you got to keep the gourmet thing.
Right.
You know, I love that concept, so that stayed in.
So right off the bat, the focus was on films with extreme gore.
Yeah, my very first column was Night of the Zombies and City of the Walking Dead in issue 13.
Issue 13. That's one of the early issues I actually don't have. It's the Troma cover story.
Yeah, that's one
Troma
of the...
Troma Films was a cover story.
That's one of the harder issues to get, too.
Yeah, I don't even think there's any copies kicking around the Rue Morgue offices.
No, they're sold out.
So how has the column changed from its inception to the way you approach it today? What's the philosophy of the column?
Originally, as I said, it was about, you know, dusty VHS bargain bin treasures. It kind of morphed. You know, I stuck to a lot of Euro horror originally, classics, just stuff that people weren't normally talking about. And then as the magazine started to grow and we started to get more screeners coming in, you know, Rodrigo started filtering titles to me that he thought would be good for the column. Ivanka kept it up. When she took over the reins, there's always been a give and take. If I have an idea, I'll pitch it. If they have something, they'll pitch it to me. You know, we decide. Nothing's set in stone. Since Dave's come on, he likes me to keep it more to the gore movies. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, I used to look at a wider range of horror movies. Still, you know, on the extreme side, still with gore, but not as focused as it has been.
A lot of people called you the gourmet.
Yes, including my own children. It mystifies me why people don't get it. It seems obvious, especially when you look at the logo for the column, which is, you know, the zombie in the butcher's apron and the menu. You would think. But Beelzebub did that to me. Doug Buck did that to me. And my own daughter did it to me.
Our daddy is the gourmet. Gourmet.
So when you look back on all the columns that you've done, what are some of your favorite ones that stick out for you? What are your proudest moments as the gourmet in the morgue?
I would have to say it would be the August Underground's Mortem column I did, because that was almost a life-changing event.
Explain.
I had just had my daughter like a month or two before when I got a call from Ivanka, not an email. I got a telephone call saying we got August Underground's Mortem. It's a sequel to the first one, which was a cover story. It wasn't a cover story. There was a feature on it. Mm-hmm. She's like, we want you to do it for your column. So I said, okay, well, if I'm going to do that, then I want to see the first one too. She's like, okay, we have that here too. So I came down here and picked up the two tapes, took them home, waited till my wife went out, put them in. And as I was watching, I was keeping one eye in the front door because I thought, how the hell am I going to explain this to a divorce lawyer if my wife catches me watching these movies? And watching them both back to back was just an intense experience. There were times I had to, like, turn the VCR off and walk away because I was just having difficulty absorbing all this onslaught.
So you're a big wimp.
No. I'm not, but I'm sitting and watching these movies. I'm going, I know this is fake. I know this is just acting, but holy shit. I mean, look at this. Fucking this slit in their belly, and there's rape in the dead baby's corpse in the, you know, the bathtub, and picking maggots off the...
Slow down, you're giving me a boner.
So, yeah, for days after, I couldn't look at my wall of DVDs. I couldn't look at my death metal stuff. I was thinking to myself, why do I think this stuff is funny? Why do I think this is amusing? Because I've always found this amusing. I mean, movies don't scare me. So, you know, I just watch it for the perverse entertainment value. And I actually question why it was I was doing this. And just having had a child, I'm thinking, what sort of example am I setting for my child with this crap?
So what sort of example are you setting?
Well, a good one. Because, no, I have put everything into context for them. I have explained that this stuff is not real. It's fake. It's fiction. And, you know, it's just for fun.
Right.
So they understand that. That's why they don't get upset watching movies.
Well, you mentioned that it was a moment for you to pause and reflect on why it is that you even pursue this kind of viewing and writing about these films. So what conclusions did you come up with during that period?
Well, when you have a child for the first few months, because, yeah, Laura wasn't that old, it changes your entire perception of life. You look at things differently. It doesn't last, though. You know, suddenly you look at the world and you're looking at the world as now you've brought this being into it and you have to protect her from, you know, right, the entire world, all the bad things that happen. And, you know, at the same time, you're reveling in the beauty of this new life. So it's kind of conflicting. And then, you know, when suddenly you're sitting down and watching, you know, a really perverse, hardcore gore movie, it just blew me off the rails for a few days.
Right.
But, you know, after a few days of thinking about it, you know, I got back the previous perspective I've had. I mean,
which is what? Like, how do you think something like the August Underground movies, which I actually only saw the first one, I never bothered watching the follow-up films because I just never really connected with the first one enough. But how do you think that relates to the sort of films that got you excited about the genre to begin with, like the Fulci films? They seem, in many ways, worlds apart.
Well, I would go back because, you know, when I was a kid, like 3 and 4 years old, I can't ever remember not being a horror fan because I was watching Ultraman, as we were talking about, 3 and 4 years old. You know, I'd wait for my friend Glenn to come home from school because I wasn't even in kindergarten yet.
Right.
So I could go to his place because his parents had cable and got, you know, WTV Buffalo 29, which showed, you know, Ultraman. So it started there. I used to watch, you know, Hilarious House of Frightenstein when it was originally running. Mm-hmm. Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? Those were the things I grew up on. You know, the after-school creature features.
All the lame stuff.
Yeah. No, you know, Godzilla movies at 4 o'clock, you know, after school. I used to run home to watch them. Movies like The Vulture and The Reptile. You know, The Horror of Dracula. You know, some of the Hammer movies.
Scooby-Dooby-Doo, where are you? We got some work to do now. Scooby-Dooby-Doo, where are you? We need some help from you now. Come on, Scooby-Doo, I see you. Pretending you've got a silver. Shake and shiver. You know we got a mystery to solve. So Scooby-Dooby, ready for your act. Don't hold back. And Scooby-Doo, if you come through, you're gonna have yourself a Scooby snack. That's a fact. Scooby-Dooby-Dooby, here are you. You're ready and you're willing. Scooby, we can count on you. Scooby-Doo, I know we'll catch that bill.
Scooby-Doo, where are you?
And then, you know, towards the end of the 70s, I was getting a little older. I remember seeing, you know, the world television premiere of Halloween. You know, I watched the original airing of Salem's Lot. Mm-hmm. You know, the Tobe Hooper miniseries. And, you know, that was fine. I was reading reference books. You know, I sort of came in right at the very tail end of the Monster Kid era. I remember the old trading cards they had with the pictures from Mask of the Red Death, you know, with some cheesy joke caption below it. And I remember having some of those. But it was when I was 15 when I saw my first videotape. Friends of my mother's, these two middle-aged ladies, were home alone. And they every weekend, they used to rent a big bag of movies and sit and knit. So, you know, I was 15. By this time, I'm starting to want to go out with my buddies and stuff. But my mother says, you know, we're going over to watch some movies. Do you want to come? They have some horror movies. So I said, all right. So I go over there, myself, my mother, and my 11-year-old brother, and these two middle-aged ladies were in their pajamas knitting. And we watched I Spit on Your Grave and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I have never felt more uncomfortable in my life than sitting in a room with my mother and these two, you know, ladies watching Camille Keaton, you know,
Were these videotapes censored?
No.
At all?
No. See, that was the beauty of how it was, because this was, like I said, like 1981.
Right.
So there weren't a lot of video stores yet. All the tapes came out from the States. Mm-hmm. The government had nothing to do with them because there was no legislation regarding
I'm not sure if those video. Titles were ever censored, were they?
No, I don't think
There's
so.
Nothing really to cut from the first Texas Chainsaw. I remember the sequel was butchered.
Yeah, it was
in
brutalized.
Ontario. It was completely
I saw it in the theater and just, I was so angry after because I knew it was destroyed.
So your first VHS viewings was I Spit on Your Grave.
And the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and that was, like, after that, I was like, that's where I got my taste for extreme horror. So, my parents never censored me. Mm-hmm. Like, when I was 11 years old, I was reading Stephen King novels, okay? Because I was a really avid reader when I was a kid, and they trusted that I was intellectually capable of sorting this stuff out for myself. So they pretty much gave me free rein to read what I wanted. Then when we got our own VCR, they, you know, specifically, I think they even had to sign a waiver at the video store or something saying that I could rent anything. And my brother as well. I'd like to think that it was because, you know, they were, you know, freeing my intellect to explore what I want. But more likely, the truth of the matter is they wanted to be able to send me to the store to get movies. So we watch on, you know, Saturday night so they wouldn't have to go themselves. So that was really it. But
did you have to pick up smokes and booze for them as well?
No, my mother used to send me to the store for smokes, you know, when she smoked. With a note, yeah.
I used to use that trick to buy cigarettes for myself.
Yeah, no, I didn't do that. I didn't start doing that until I was in my teens. But yeah, so that's how I, you know, gained a taste for more extreme
right.
you know, types of films. So I spent the next... Well, I guess up until the late 90s, going to video stores and just rooting through to see what they had for rent or for sale, mm-hmm. taking them home. If I couldn't buy them, I duped them. And, you know, there was a period of time where I was getting titles like Death Faces and Traces of Death and Shocking Faces of Death, the reality death mm-hmm. stuff. And I thought that made me pretty hardcore. I thought it doesn't get more fucking hardcore than watching, you know, people die. Watching somebody who's been ripped apart in an accident scene, you know, somebody's murdered corpse. But then one day, I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? This is tragedy. I mean, this is somebody's death. What I want, you know, my mother, you know, if she died in a car accident, have somebody there with a camera filming her last breaths as her jaws half hanging off her face. And I just I revoked it. Mm. I refuse to look at it now. All the stuff that's on the internet makes me very sad. But getting back to August Underground, that was sort of an extension of that whole reality death thing, mm-hmm. except that this is all fake, right? Special effects. They are harsh movies. I have them now on DVD because Mortem has a great big quote for me on the front cover, which I think is cool. And also, it has that column as an Easter egg on the disc. To me, they're the equivalent of the Japanese guinea pig series. I think they'll always be remembered in that vein. So I'm not, you know, I'm sort of proud to be connected to them as I am. And I know the Toe Tag folks. I know Michael Todd Schneider, you know, Mikey Maggot. And they're really good people. They're nothing at all, you know, like they appear in the movies. They're, as are everybody I've met in this business who has made some of the most fucked up shit you could ever see. They're all thoroughly normal, down-to-earth, you know, friendly people. Have you ever met, you know, a freak in this business? Don't point at me.
That's a weird question to ask me as I'm sitting across from you, but I think I have met lots of freaks.
I don't consider myself a freak or a geek or a nerd.
Well, I respectfully disagree on all of that.
Horror is one of my interests. I right. like music as well. And not just, you know, horror music. I actually don't listen to a lot of horror music. I listen to a lot of metal, which has horror aspects to it, but I don't consider it horror music. I don't listen to it because it's scary. I just like the musicianship and the aggression of it.
We just touched upon this, the whole reality horror thing. We live in a day where it's very radically different from when we were younger, seeing stuff like Faces of Death and those reality death tapes. There was an illicit quality to them. It felt like you were watching something forbidden and underground, and they didn't. They existed largely because people had copies of them on VHS, and they would
they were not easy to find.
Right. Now, in 2 seconds, I can go online, and I haven't done this, but I could probably find that. What's the guy, Lucas?
Luca Magnata.
Right. This is a bloke who just made a video where he chops somebody up, has sex with the dismembered corpse, and eats parts of the body on camera. And it's available to see on the internet. So how does that reality color and change the meaning of these fictional horror films and these fictional gore films that you write about? Do they even have a place? Do they have any relevance when we live in a world where the real life snuff movies that we could only imagine when we were young are freely available for people to just download for free, and it takes them about 5 seconds to find them on the internet?
I don't know how you could really reconcile that. You know, as I said, I refuse to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's three guys, one hammer. You know, the three guys who film themselves murdering somebody in Russia. There's been the, you know, jihadist beheading videos and all that stuff. I just refuse to watch it. I do not acknowledge its existence. I do not give those people an audience, because that's what they want. That's why they put that stuff up there. They want people to watch it. All I can do is deprive them of one audience member.
Right.
Remember sitting at work when you know, I was working the night shift and the jihadist videos came out. I think it was when Daniel Pearl was murdered. My coworkers looked it up and all gathered around the monitor and watched it. They had the volume up. I was the only one who refused to watch it. I stayed at my desk, continued to work. You know, they're going, holy shit, should we watch this? And they did. When you watch something like that, you give something of yourself away that you can never get back. I think you just debase yourself watching those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just give away a little piece of your soul. And you can't get it back. You cannot unsee those things. So I'm sad that people want to watch those kind of things.
But why do you want to watch the fictional stuff?
Well, why not? It's fiction. It's cathartic.
But does the fictional stuff, the extreme gore, have a place in a world where the real gore is freely available to watch?
Well, it's artistry, and if you're so inclined, you at least have something to judge against about how special the special effects are, if you want to look at it that way. If it's part of a fictional narrative, you know, certainly it has a reason to be there. Something like, you know, the August Underground movies are unique and they don't really have a narrative structure. There sort of is one throughout the different episodes, but right. It's supposed to be just, you know, found footage. But those movies were originally made and came out, you know, before the real life gore on the internet
exploded.
Got to the level where it is now. There weren't sites like, well, I'm not going to name the sites because I don't want to give them any publicity, but there weren't sites like that really back then. There was only one or two. Right. It was like the VHS.
What I'm saying is those websites have really rendered a type of horror film extinct. You know, there's no point in an August Underground type movie now. Who would even care to watch that or make that? Maybe they're of their time.
They're of their time. Those movies are done. I mean, Toteg's not making any more. Although they have, I think there's another volume of their murder collection, which is a recreation of exactly these kind of videos we're talking about, which is actually quite well done.
What's the point?
To see Jeremy Cruz's effects. Because he's an amazing effects artist. When you know what the real stuff looks like, you can, you know, marvel at the fake stuff. I don't know. It's
sounds unsatisfying.
It's a moral dichotomy. I guess I have to face.
I didn't watch that Luke Magnotta video, and out of respect for you, I won't even name the website where it was posted. But I did read the comments from the viewers, the blog comments, the YouTube-esque comments. That there was a whole thread of them.
Yes, I read them too.
It blew me away. That totally blew me away. Because, actually, ironically, at the time, I was working on a fictional piece about somebody making some extreme films, and then the audience gets to see them, and he becomes disturbed by the audience reaction because they're just swallowing it like it's mindless entertainment. They can't determine that it's actually real. They think it's fake. Right at the time that I was working on this thing, I go on that website and I see those real comments, and the reality of those comments was far more disturbing and extreme than anything I even imagined as a futuristic science fiction scenario. We're living in a futuristic dystopian science fiction reality right now, because those kids were commenting on the Luke Magnotta video in terms of like, oh, I thought it was weak when he did this. It wasn't effective. And the use of music. There were a lot of comments on the use of music.
Yeah.
And criticizing his choice of
disturbing
music.
Disturbing, was it? And I've seen worse.
And contrasting it with the, you mentioned it, the Three Guys, One Hammer video.
One Hammer, yeah.
Even the name of it is just so disturbing. The fact that that's a real life murder video. One of 23 that those guys shot, by the way. In a matter of about 3 weeks, and only one got leaked out. And I think the whole clip is like about 7 minutes. And I actually started to watch it. About a minute in, I stopped. And that was the end point for me in terms of ever wanting to look at this kind of real life violence. And I feel very similar to you. In terms of being an audience for it, I don't want to be an audience for it, even though I do have a morbid curiosity. But that disturbed me so much that it took me quite a few days to really think about it. And I had to research it, and I had to do a lot of thinking in order to understand why those three kids would so callously kill and torture a man in this brutal way on camera, and they're almost bored doing it. They're almost like halfway through it, they kind of like give up, like in terms of even deriving any like extreme rush from it. There's a banality to it that's excruciatingly disturbing. And I had to really think about and come to terms with and understand the psychology of what would drive them to do it. And
well, I think, yeah, the banality of evil. That's what I thought that was really well addressed in Snowtown.
Right.
Justin Kurzel's movie about the bodies in the barrels murders in Australia. Because they're not like stark raving lunatic psychopaths. They're otherwise normal people who do very bad things. But obviously there's a desensitizing process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're watching this stuff, yeah, you watch enough of it. You're not going to get a charge out of it anymore.
But what else is it doing? Because in recent months, we've had this weird spate of really gruesome crimes, especially all this face-eating thing that's been going on. It's become a trend, eating somebody's fucking face. This shit didn't happen before that I remember. I don't remember this being in the news in the 70s or the 80s or the 90s. Why is it happening now? And I was talking to a friend. And this friend isn't in any way interested in the horror genre. We used to watch horror movies way back in the 80s together. But he's since, you know, moved on and he has no interest in it. And I said, what do you think of all this weird faces and stuff that's been going on? And the first thing he hit back is, what do you expect people to do now?
You have to top the last psychopath?
And he mentioned, like, how movies, I don't necessarily subscribe to this view completely, but But he talked about how movies have desensitized people, and they can no longer determine reality from fiction. And that's evidenced by those comments that we talked about in that Luke Magnotta video.
Yeah, because there were people who were saying it was fake. Well, those special effects are pretty good, but it's fake. No, it's not. It's a murder. See,
but do you think this stuff is having a negative, accumulative effect on society as a whole? This sort of increasing extreme levels of visceral violence that we're being exposed to, faced in a fictional sense in movies as they increase in their extreme nature. Because what we see in an R-rated film today would be unthinkable 20 years ago. Even in extreme gore films coming from Italy, the stuff that you can see in the multiplex now in a Saw movie is actually more extreme than the stuff we thought was illicit and forbidden 20 years ago. So, accumulatively, do you think these films are having a negative impact on society as a whole?
Okay, the one thing I noticed, having worked in the media for the last 15 years, is that we know more now than we ever did before, because there is complete media saturation. So you have all these various outlets, they're all looking for the juicy story, and we're inundated with this. As the Luca Magnotta character, he was all over the news here. You know, it's pretty rare for something, you know, this evil to happen in Canada. So, of course, it was big news.
But newspapers have been on that type of stuff from day one, though.
Yeah, but we're getting it everywhere. All the cable news channels.
Right.
You know, it's just they need to cover this stuff, so there's 24-hour coverage of it. And you know, it's easy. I remember watching the 9/11 attack. My mother woke me up saying that a plane had crashed into the building. I got to bed. My wife was in Holland at the time. She actually flew to Holland the day before the attack. So I worked nights. My mother woke me up early. I came downstairs. I switched it on. It must have been just after 9 o'clock to see what was going on. That was before the second building was hit. I didn't move from the couch until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I couldn't leave, and I had to go to work. And I knew when I got to work that I was going to have to slog through all the papers and all the news stories on this and put them on the internet. That was very depressing. And, you know, having worked as I did, putting papers on the internet and combing through papers from all across the country, I would spend 40 hours a week being inundated with this stuff. And I'm watching all these movies and I'm writing about it, and I can't say it's had a negative effect on me, but I have a pretty strong personality to begin with. So I don't know if the world is getting crazier or we're just hearing about more of the crazy events. You know, there was the shooting in the theater in Colorado during the Batman movie. The guy was dressed up as a character, you know, Bane. Why does somebody do something like that? I don't understand. I spent years trying to understand that by reading a lot of true crime books, you know, criminal psychology studies. And so I was trying to figure out why people do these things, and I've never been able to find an answer for it.
I think people who write about genre films and discuss them or defend them in the media, whenever there's a situation like the Denver, Colorado thing, you always get the same kind of reactions. You get people opposed to films who believe it's a negative influence, making the case that we've got to clamp down on the movies and the movies are to blame. And then you get the apologists, and a lot of genre journalists sort of jump to this position where they're saying, no, horror movies are a healthy outlet, and it's the parents to blame and it's other factors to blame. And I actually don't subscribe to either of those views. I think they're both they miss the mark. I think it's very unrealistic to think that movies don't have an influence. They do. We know they do. There was a famous, Clark Gable, when he took off a shirt, or he didn't have an undershirt on or something, and apparently undershirt sales went down, like, drastically. Movies affect behavior. You saw that with the Columbine thing. Those kids were, like, watching, I think, like, John Woo movies or something. And if you see the footage of them, you can tell that they're living out fantasies that they've fed by watching movies and watching, you know, extreme
and playing violent
films.
Video games.
Exactly. They have an influence. And we have video games now where you can just sit in the bushes and, you know, like, if you play Grand Theft Auto, You can drive around, pick up a prostitute. At least this is how I play the game. Drive around, pick up a prostitute, have sex with her in the park, smash her over the head with a baseball bat and steal your money back.
Yeah.
Or you can sit in the bushes with a sniper rifle and just shoot passers-by. Or, obviously the best thing, just drive around in a sports car, wasting as many people as you humanly can. Now, is that a healthy way to spend time in terms of... Is that a healthy way to kind of express a lot of pent-up hostility? Or does it actually desensitize us to the consequence of violence? And does it have a negative influence on us? I think potentially it does. You know, I think it's wrong to assume that all the blame lies outside of the movies and the video games, as much as it's wrong to assume that all the blame lies there as well. I think the movies and video games have a very complicated impact, and there needs to be some level of accountability there, absolutely, because I think it does have a negative impact on people's overall perception. Not on a, necessarily a psychopath, because you can't extend that logic. Like Charles Manson listened to the Beatles' White Album, and it was a recipe for him to create those grisly crimes. Well, obviously the Beatles never intended anything of the sort. So a psychopath will take from something totally benign some hidden weird cue to do something bizarre. Like if they're affected by a piece of media. Like Catcher in the Rye apparently supposedly inspired the dude, what's his name, asshole character. I forget his name now, gratefully. The fellow that killed John Lennon.
Oh, Mark David Chapman.
Yeah. Apparently, Catcher in the Rye was an influence on that. Taxi Driver, well, that's a bit more extreme, you know, inspired somebody to try to kill Ronald Reagan to prove his love for Jodie Foster. So a psychopath will take anything. I mean, if you can listen to the Beatles' White Album and then go, oh, you know what? The Beatles are telling me to go to the Beverly Hills and waste a bunch of actors.
Because there's a race war coming and, you know, we're going to come out and be kings of the black people.
So you can't blame movies for that. But at the same time, I think that we're being progressively desensitized. When I read those comments in relationship to the Luca Magnotta video, I have to wonder, where are we going? What's happening? What are the forces that are lining up to push us along this path? And it's hard to make sense out of what's been going on with all the face-eating. These weird, like, out of nowhere attacks.
Well, okay, some of those were the results of using this illegal drug, bath salts.
Yeah.
But apparently, the first one, the guy in Florida, they didn't find any traces of that stuff in his system.
Right.
Only marijuana, and I don't think pot gives you those kind of munchies. I don't know what it is. Certainly, I mean, I don't play video games, but I do know what you're talking about. Technology is driving a lot of this. You know, we can't keep up with technology. You know, it's just, it's advancing so rapidly. We can't cope. And certainly, it's allowing things like Grand Theft Auto, you know, for you to assume the role of a brutal killer and live out your fantasies. And certainly, I would have to agree that there is a desensitizing factor to that. You know, movies are rougher than they've ever been than they were when we're growing up. You know, it always makes me laugh when people talk about grindhouse movies and how dirty and perverted they were. If you watch most of them, it's pretty tame stuff. You know, you see these homages like Dear God No or Hobo with a Shotgun, and they're completely over the top. The movies that they're, you know, paying tribute to are not.
No.
You know.
They're paying tribute more to the posters.
Yeah.
Because the exploitation films that we associate with this grindhouse era, the horror films, they were marketed with really lurid posters that were far more extreme than the movies themselves and offered more visceral thrills. So I think what you see with this current generation of young filmmakers who are making these retrospective films, they're trying to... Well, that was the agenda with Grindhouse. That was exactly the agenda with Tarantino's Grindhouse, was to basically deliver on the promise of the poster, which those films never did. and basically use A-list resources to create the sort of films that they tricked you into thinking you were going to see. I'm not sure how successful it was, but it was successful to a degree.
That carried over into VHS box art in the 80s.
Yeah.
Because how many times did you look at a cover and go, oh, wow, I got to rent this. You take it home, put it in, and the pictures on the box aren't even from the movie.
Yeah.
And you're like, fuck, this movie sucks. Damn it. Wasted my $250.
So what I'm trying to ask you, though, is where is all this going? Give me the Gourmet's Nostradamus type overview on how this whole culture of horror and society is going to play out in the years to come, in the immediate years to come. How do you see it all unfolding from here?
Well, horror as a genre has always been cyclical in nature. I'm surprised we haven't had a full downturn yet. It's been threatening to sort of fade away. You know, which is something I always have to keep looking a few months ahead because I have to find things to write about for the magazine, right? I always like to keep my, have something planned out for an issue or two. But, you know, at this point in time, I'm having difficulty finding anything that I want to write about. You know, we'll see what happens with when Fantasia ends, what comes out of there. And TIFF, of course. But I certainly think it's horror is heading for another downturn. You know, 90s weren't so great. You know, the big boon and the aughts. But I think things have kind of been tapering off lately. Either that or all this crazy real-life violence is going to inspire people to make even insane movies. I don't know. How much further can you go now? But I like to say, you know, I've seen it all, but there's always something that comes out that surprises me.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the line of a dark black night. Black night. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
When you look back on all the articles you've written, and all the columns you've done, and all the pieces you've done for Rue Morgue in general, what are some of the things you're most proud of?
Do you know how many pieces there are in that? 12 and a half years? 112 issues?
Yeah, but when you think back, what are some that bubble to the surface?
Okay, well, as I was discussing the piece on August Underground's Mortem, I'm proud that's included as an Easter egg on the DVD.
Anything that sort of feeds your ego is...
Well, no, that's nice. No, it's nice that I'm on the DVD. You know, I have some cover quotes. I think I'm on just about every DVD of Slime City that's come out. You know, that's awesome. Certainly meeting people, the stuff I've written about Greg Lamberson's movies. Mm-hmm. Greg's a great guy. You know, he's helped me out in a pinch last year with the panel I did at the Festival of Fear. The Cannibal Holocaust feature I did was, that was fun.
Right. Oh, yes, that was a good one. I enjoyed that.
That was, no, but just the interview process.
Yeah.
Okay, because I interviewed Carl York, who's Gabriel York in the movie. He's the leader of the filmmakers. Talked to him for a half hour. Great guy. Funny. Answered all the questions. Everything was fine. Spoke to Robert Kerman. Just, it took me days to get a hold of him. He finally agreed to call me at like 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning, which is okay because I got home from work at that time. I had 2 hours of tape and it ran out.
Wow.
On the conversation. It was about everything. It was just a storm of manic depression. Oh, it was horrible.
Sort of like this conversation.
You know, something I got the tape, all of it still. I put it on a DVD. It was fun talking to...
Is that tape usable? Is the audio usable?
Wait, I'm not giving it to you. But yeah, so the music pieces have been fun. You know, I got to interview Matt Harvey from Exhumed when he brought the band back out. And I got to meet him on tour. You know, we had a great conversation. It was a lot of fun. So meeting him in person was good.
Right.
Same with George Corpse Grinder Fisher from Cannibal Corpse. You know, interviewed him and then got to meet him in person. It's like, hey, you know, good to meet you. That was fun. Tim Sullivan, you know, interviewed him for 2001 Maniacs, Field of Screams. We had a great conversation. He came here in the city. You know, it was really nice to meet him in person. I recruited him to do the VHS panel I did last year. He was happy to do it. And, you know, we both acted together in a low-budget horror film for Michael Todd Schneider.
Which we'll get into in a minute.
Yeah. So, I got to meet Dario Argento, you know, because you were there before the screening of Mother of Tears. And I gave him the lobby card from Cat and Nine Tails, and he signed it. When I phoned him the following February or March to interview him, he said, we met before, the hotel. I said, yeah, I had the lobby card. I was like, I remember you. You had the lobby card from Cat of Nine Tails.
Wow. It's incredible he remembered that, because he must have signed about a million posters and stuff when he was here.
Yeah. But he didn't remember breaking my fucking camera. I'd been taking pictures all night, and, you know, we finally got to meet Argento, and Rob was there. I'm like, you know, I asked Dario if I could just get a picture, and he said yes. Gave the camera to Rod. Rod took the picture. Halfway through, the camera froze, and it never worked again. And the picture only half came out. It's weird. So Dario broke my camera.
I guess it's true what they say about vampires on film.
Thank you.
I want to talk about an article you wrote for issue number 83. And it was the Halloween issue, and it features a Basil Gogo's portrait of Forrest Ackerman. Shortly before he died, actually.
Yes.
And you wrote this piece, The 50 Essential Gore Films.
I did.
Do you still stand by that article?
Of course I do. Do you know how much work I put into that? Holy shit, I watched most of those movies. It was the most intense month I think I've ever had in my life. Because I'm like, okay, I got to put this on the list, but I haven't seen this in ages. No, actually, there was one worse than that. It was the Lucio Fulci filmography.
Oh, right.
Which, at the time, I thought I was splitting with our good friend Chris Alexander.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, it all got put on me.
So you basically, in that one, for the Fulci thing, you did a capsule review of most of his... All his films? His golden era?
No, all of his giallo and horror movies.
Right.
Which were 28. I had to buy a bunch of them. Which is fine, because you can never have enough Fulci.
Well, I want to take issue with something you wrote in this piece. And I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to introduce you to maybe a couple of films that you've never seen.
Okay.
Right now, on the show, live. The first film that you write about in the 50 Essential Gore Films is 1963's Blood Feast, the film that's often been cited as the first gore movie or the first film that's ushered in the gore film.
Are you going to bring up Jigoku?
No, I'm going deeper into the annals of cinematic ephemera than that. By many decades, by over half a century. Just bear with me. You said, there is no definitive first gore film. The use of gory special effects to shock viewers goes back at least as far as Louis Bunuel and Salvador Dali's Un Chien Andalou in 1929, in which a woman's eyeball is sliced open with a straight razor in close-up. There is a definitive first gore film. And I'm going to show it to you right now. It's not from 1929. It's not from 1919. It's not even from the 1900s. It's from 1895, at the very beginning of cinema, when Thomas Edison was producing these, like, one-minute little things that would play in kinetoscopes. Have you ever seen The Execution of Mary, Queen of Scots?
Well, no.
Well, Mr. Gourmet, may I present to you the very first definitive gore film ever made from 1895.
Okay, this is going to be interesting. Are you going to start it from the beginning?
It's 18 seconds long. So basically, what I want you to do is I want you, as I play this clip, you can get this on YouTube if you look for The Execution of Mary Stuart. And as I play it, would you please describe for the listeners what we're looking at, as best as you can?
Okay, so let me lean over here.
Here it is.
The title card reads, The Execution of Mary, Queen of Scots, August 28th, 1895, Edison Laboratory. And we have a woman about to get her head chopped off. She's kneeling in front of the executioner's pillar and whack, off with her head. That's pretty awesome. There's a jump cut, though. And it ends with the executioner picking up the severed head.
So you actually picked up on the jump cuts.
Yeah.
That was, as far as I believe, the first example of what was known at the time as stop action, where they stop filming and then replace something in the scene and then replay the camera. It's often been credited to Georges Méliès as having invented. In fact, he had a nice story about one time he was filming a street scene in Paris and his camera jammed, and when he got it working again, when he looked at the film, he saw one vehicle magically turn into another one, and then he discovered stop motion. Well, actually, this predates any of the Georges Méliès stuff. This is from 1895, and it was a deliberate use of stop action where they stopped the film and then replaced the body with a dummy. And then continued. Now, the first time I ever saw that, I actually didn't catch the stop action, because it's quite cleverly done. I think it's when he's bringing the axe up and there's other stuff to distract you.
Yeah.
And then as he comes down, it's just like, holy fuck, he just chopped that woman's head off. Well, a lot of people
I was watching Mary the whole time, and that's when I caught it.
That's why you were... If you were watching the executioner, you wouldn't have caught the replacement dummy. You would have just seen this woman's head come off. A lot of people think this is a real snuff movie from 1895.
it is convincing.
That is definitively the first gore movie.
Well, okay, I'll give you that.
And I'm not sure if the other films have survived, but Edison was producing a lot of gore films at that time. Lynchings of cowboys, scalpings by Indians. These were the sort of things that he was putting in those kinetoscopes. Cockfights, animal snuff films. Long before Ruggiero Deodato, Edison was producing animal snuff movies for American audiences. Let me show you another one.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've seen this one before. Here we see a handler leading an elephant, one of the planet's most noblest beasts.
Now, here's the thing with these. A lot of people, I'm not quite sure what the full context of this, because Edison used to electrocute elephants to show that, was it alternating current? Tesla had he had direct current, and I think Tesla had alternating current, and to try to discredit his competition, because Edison was a ruthless businessman and a human being, he electrocuted an elephant and other animals to show that the other type of electricity was bad for you or something. So it was just a hideous display. Now, this video, I'm not quite sure if it was filmed to illustrate the alternating current situation. They were actually legitimately executing this elephant for killing one of the circus handlers or somebody that was cruel to the elephant. They gave it a lighted cigarette butt as a treat. They thought that would be funny. So the elephant didn't think so. So the elephant killed that person. And having taken a human life, they decided to execute it and they filmed it. This is from 1903.
Okay, yes, we're walking the elephant onto some type of platform, and the animal is standing there, and now smoke is coming in from the animal's feet, and it slowly collapses and dies, all rigid. See, that's disgusting. One of the things I hate that we do here is, you know, somebody will be out in some animal's natural habitat and is attacked by that animal, and they go out and try and hunt it down and kill it. And I think that's wrong. You know, if the animal comes into your bedroom and bothers you, sure, but when you're out in the woods somewhere, tromping around their habitat, and that animal reacts to you, killing it is wrong.
Of course.
That movie was wrong.
But if you ever do this article again, you got to include Thomas Edison in there.
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of Chikoku, which is Japanese film.
65 years after the Mary execution of Mary.
And Monster, it's like
practically one of the very first films ever made was a gore
Blancus
movie.
Which came out in the late 50s. There's another flick called Flesh Eaters. It has some rudimentary gore effects. But the first guy who used gore as the attraction was H.G. Lewis. That's why I started with him.
So you don't think the execution of Mary was using gore as the attraction? That was the whole movie, 18 seconds of a beheading. And then the interesting thing is when he holds the head up at the very end, it really recalls this recent spate of real beheading videos. They're all like practically cheering as he's holding up the severed head.
Well, certainly, but how many people know that these movies exist?
Anyone listening to this podcast?
All 14 of you. That was it? You didn't want to call me out in any of the other titles in there?
Oh, you want to get into some of the more stuff? I'm not trying to call you out, by the way. I'm just more excited to be able to show you the very first gore film. I can always tell people now. Yeah? Well, I showed the gourmet the very first definitive gore movie.
Yeah, well,
so how
see,
about
here's,
that?
Here's the thing you were talking about, insecure and neurotic journalists and everything.
I was talking about me. But clearly,
I do not call myself an expert in the genre. I don't claim to know it all or to have seen it all, because that is virtually impossible to do.
Exactly.
So I know what I know, and I write about it. Obviously, I know a lot about certain kinds of movies, but not everything. There's always something you haven't seen. That's one of the reasons why I like the horror genre, because you can't know it all. You can't see enough. You get people on the internet are like, oh, I've seen it all, this movie's that. They're idiots. Fuck you, you don't know anything. It's rampant on the internet. It was happening back in the alt-out horror days. You know, everything was Freddy and Jason, and, you know, if it didn't come from Hollywood, it didn't matter.
I actually don't really want to be flipping through this, because this is from my private collection, and I don't like to get thumbprints on the on the printed pages. But
well, one of the things, because I snuck around and read critiques of it online. I never responded to any of them, but you know, I just checked a few message boards to see what people were saying about it. One of the things I got critiqued for was, like, not putting in the most obvious, you know, gore movies there are, like Reanimator and Dawn of the Dead. Oh, why aren't these movies in there? Because why do I have to tell you about them? If you're complaining they're not in there, you already know about them. You don't need to tell you about them. My goal
but the
was
article
to get,
is 50 essential.
Yeah, but it is not the 50 best or the 50 greatest or the 50 goriest. I think if you want to call yourself a gore hound, you need to see all those movies that are on that list, because you all have already have seen Dead Alive, which actually I didn't want to put on there. I wanted to put Bad Taste, but that was one of the arguments I lost with the editors.
It should say 50 essential alternative gore films.
There's no such thing as an alternative gore film.
I'm just busting your balls. This is good. This is a good resource. I still actually haven't seen all these movies that are on this list.
I mean, how many people would think of Criminally Insane? I love that movie. It was made for about $50. It just has this warped charm to it. See, Luther the Geek was another one that I people are like, why is Luther the Geek in there? It's not even a gore movie. Well, it is. And if you were a reader of Gore Zone back in the late 80s, you would have seen stills of the film from when it was in production. Luther and his big teeth biting some old lady's necks. Great effect. You know, that was cut out of the video that eventually made its way up here. Another movie that was like that was Scott Spiegel's Intruder. When it finally was released on video, it was cut to shit. All the juicy bits were in Gore Zone, and you had to have that issue to even know about this. If you didn't, you would have just said, that movie sucked. It doesn't even make any sense because it's all jumpy.
Right.
Because they hacked out all the gore. So those were one of the things that informed me back in the day, and I'm putting it forward to hopefully, you know, a new generation.
It seems like a daunting task to put 50 movies together.
Oh, it is, believe me.
And then to write capsule reviews for each one of them. Because capsule reviews are the worst to write. You know, if people listening write articles or reviews, they know what we're talking about. But it's actually easier to write, in some ways, like a 3 or 4 page thing than a 150-word thing.
Yeah, well, see, I have
mad skills.
Well, yeah, actually, I don't have a lot of problem writing reviews that small most of the time. Sometimes it can be very difficult. Yes, it's not easy to do, because I was going to say you can go on the internet and call up blogs, and all you're greeted with are monolithic blocks of text that start at the top and run all the way down to the bottom of the screen. There's no paragraph breaks. People think that being in depth means using a lot of words, and they just keep saying the same things over again in the review. They're using 9 words to say something you could say with 3 carefully chosen words. Because that's, to me, has always been the key to writing. You have to be economical. You have to pick just the right words to convey what it is you're trying to get across. I use a thesaurus a lot, just looking for that right word, because I also like to have a flow in my writing. I like alliteration, for example. I always think that's cute to have a little bunch of words that all start with the same consonant. There's an art to what we do. A lot of people do it, but they don't bring any art to it. They just bring monolithic blocks of text that you start reading and you just zone out halfway through and you're like, fuck it. You waste your time when you do that. If you're going to write 1,500 words about a movie, you better have a hell of a lot of things to say about it, not just run through the whole plot, spoil everything, and then say why you like the movie at the end. There's a lot of bad writing out there. I try not to contribute to it. I work very hard.
Do you enjoy writing?
Sometimes. Sometimes I hate it. It depends. No, because having to regularly produce copy for the magazine, there are times where I'm not in the mood. I just don't feel like it. I don't feel inspired. But they're waiting in the other room. Well, not literally. Because I write at home and email it in, but there are people relying on me to send in copy so they can put out a magazine and make their livelihood. So I have to, whether I want to or not. Sometimes you see a movie, you're like, oh, fuck, that was great. Sit down, bang out a piece in no time. Other times, I will spend 4 hours shifting two sentences around in a paragraph, trying to get it to work. Those are the times I hate writing. Because you know what I'm talking about.
It's an agony.
Yeah.
All right, so that's it for another episode of the RoomOrg podcast. Tune in next time for the nail-biting conclusion of my interrogation with the one and only Gourmet. Leave your comments on the RoomOrg blog at www.roo-morg.com.
She's not a girl who misses much. Oh, yeah. Well acquainted with the touch of the velvet hand, like a lizard on a window pane. The man in the crowd with the multicolored mirrors on his hobnail boots, lying with his eyes while his hands are busy working overtime. A soap impression of his wife, which he ate and donated to the National Trust. I'm going down, down to the bits that I left uptown. I need a fix, cause I'm going down. Mother Superior jumped the gun. 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 Mother Superior jumped the gun.
Happiness is a warm gun. Happiness is a warm gun, mama. When I hold you in my arms and I feel my finger on your trigger, I know nobody can do